Welcome back as we continue our journey of exploring everything that Jesus said and did in his Gospels. In this particular Gospel, it's the Gospel of John chapter 7. Recapping a little, Jesus has been talking to a multitude of different characters up to this point in chapter 7. Some with success, like the Samaritan village and the Samaritan town, Nicodemus, and some with disappointment, like in chapter 6, the very large crowd up in the Sea of Galilee area, particularly around the town of Capernaum and Tiberias, where Jesus has ministered strong, ministered hard, done amazing miracles, bred out of nothing, and yet only achieved a fan base and not any followers. Jesus has a way of discerning in himself who's a follower and who's a fan and who's a foe. But he's also interested in us knowing, and so he'll sometimes say some very challenging, potentially offensive things, just so we can clear it in our own mind and our own heart. And that appears to be one of the ways Jesus taught. He didn't necessarily come to collect and gather everyone on the same page. He came with a truth and a message from his dad, which was that he had sent the Son into the world to save a world that was very bad, and that they were to follow him, which is a tough thing to say. If I asked you to go out and say, you've got to tell everyone you're the one, it's a tough thing to do. It's a very tough thing to do. And yet, it was his dad's will that he do it, and that he do it. He helped him along in a number of ways. He sent people before him, like John the Baptist, saying, John's coming, he'll lay a foundation, straighten a few things out for you. And dad also said to his son, I'll work in the ones that are yours. It won't just be you out there by yourself. I'll be there, gnawing away at the inside, letting them know that you're the one. So there'll be a double witness from the spiritual realm. One through you and one from me. Difficult task, but not alone. With Jesus, he's been a success in terms of showing people how powerful he was in the Galilee, but not a success in convincing people he was their judge and their resurrector and the one who determines whether they have existence in an eternal life. They just weren't interested in an eternal aspect of anything in particular. They were very interested in feeding their bellies. They just couldn't manage to get themselves off thinking about this world and this life and thinking about entire existence and forever life. Anyway, let's pick this story up as Jesus is about to head down for a tussle in the temple down in Jerusalem. Chapter 7. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea, which is further down south near Jerusalem, because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now, just clarifying, the word Jews has a number of different meanings in John. There's the whole Jewish people, and then there's a subset of those who are actually out to kill Jesus, who are the leaders in charge, the Sanhedrin, the priests. So there's an elite group in charge that really don't like Jesus. Now, the Jews' Feast of Booths was at hand. So yeah, there's three major feasts that the Jews celebrate in a yearly cycle. They have their Passover, where God released them from the grip of the Egyptians. They have their Tabernacles, which is where they remind themselves how whilst they were wandering away from Egypt and waiting to get into the promised land, God had to sustain them in the desert through manna, protection, water, and they were in tents the whole time. And so they collect in Jerusalem once a year and sleep in tents just to remember that time about how faithful God was. And they have their third feast, which is their Pentecost, which is a harvest feast, and it's also reported that that's when the Jews actually received the book of the law whilst they were in their wilderness wanderings. Not only did God provide for them in tents, but he also gave them a way to live, the law. And that was given at Pentecost. The Christians have equivalents of these things. We have the Passover has become our Easter because Jesus died and rose in that time. And at Pentecost, we don't celebrate the giving of the Jewish law or a harvest festival, but we do celebrate the giving of the Spirit, which was at Pentecost. There are some Christians who gather regularly to celebrate tabernacles, believing it has some significance regarding the return, well, both the birth time of Jesus and perhaps the return time of Jesus, not the day, not the hour, but the season. They were seeking to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Booths was at hand. So his brothers, that's Jesus' brothers, said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." So these are Jesus' half-brothers, because they're of Joseph and Mary, and he is of God and Mary, depending on how you look at it. But if he's to be born of both the flesh and the spirit, and tempted in all ways, and I presume he had something from Mary and something from God. But the spirit always overcame the flesh. Whatever temptation came through his flesh. But his brothers were, of course, flesh and flesh, not spirit and flesh. And they had lived with him probably for 30 years or more at this stage. In the house he grew up, he would have been the head son, learning the trade from dad. And he had been so quiet about who he was that they were not impressed at all with his being the judge of the world, the resurrector of the dead, the only Son of God. It would be hard. If you actually grew up for a long time with someone and they didn't show you who they were, to actually suddenly change and believe, "Oh, actually, just thought he was my big bro. A little bit different, but wow, way different. Wonder if he's all there. He's saying the most amazingly outlandish things lately. I think we'll call him out on it." For not even his brothers believed in him. Well, Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come. Your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." After this, he remained in Galilee. So it would have been a few days' walk to get down to Jerusalem. Brothers are chiding him. "Come on then. You're amazing. Show yourself to the world. Prove it. Why are you hiding up here? You chicken?" I don't really think we believe you, Jesus. Not that you're the king of the world. Not that you can raise people from the dead at the end of time. No. Special, different, yep. Not that guy, though. Grew up with you. Sometimes your family don't believe in you. Jesus filled with the Spirit of God, and things started happening mightily when he turned 30. And he broke into open ministry and started declaring everything that Dad wanted him to do and say. Up to that point, pretty quiet. Pretty quiet, as proven by his family's response. And they were struggling with this sudden turn of the spiritual movement of Jesus. So how is he doing this? Perhaps they didn't realize that God himself had now fully activated himself inside Jesus' human body. And so fully God and fully man was now on display. So Jesus sort of said, not going up yet. Not with you guys. You'll get away with it. They won't hate you. But I'm going to go down there. They hate me because I judge them. I tell them, you got this wrong? Yeah, that's all right. You got that wrong? Do you know why you got it wrong? You're fleshy. You're not hearing God. You're not telling people what God should be like. And of course, the religious leaders, it was their job to do that. And they were basically giving a fail from Jesus, saying, fail. Just hang on. I will correct you. I will show you what God's about, what the code from Moses was about, and how it's going to change now. I'll show you how. But after his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. The Jews were looking for him at the feast and saying, "Where is he?" And there was much muttering about him among the people. Jesus didn't lie. If you look in the Greek, you'll see that some of the words used in the Greek were Jesus wasn't going up at that time, kairos, or it wasn't appointed for him to go at the same time as his brothers. And Jesus was not yet hupo, going up to the feast. Not as in, I'm not going, and then suddenly I went anyway, so I tricked you. No. So if you can have a closer look at the language, you can get confidence that Jesus was just saying to them, I'm not going with you because they'll kill me if they see me in public going with you. You'll get away, but I won't, because I keep telling them about themselves. And there was much muttering about him among the people. Some said, he's a good man. Others said, no, he is leading the people astray. Yet for fear of the Jews, you know, that's the religious leaders in charge with the power. For fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of him. Sounds like a cult, really, doesn't it? Where you're not allowed to have your own discussion and your own thoughts and your own open debate. Where if you speak up against the leading group, it's going to be bad for you. Not allowed to contest it. I'll just give you a flavour of what sort of leadership was in charge of God's chosen people. So the feast was about 7 or 8 days. So about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching. Okay. He did more than just attend. He opened his mouth and started to teach some of that stuff that they hated so much. The Jews therefore marveled, saying, how is it that this man has learning when he's never studied? Jesus answered them, my teaching is not mine, but his, who sent me. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether my teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority. Okay, Jesus is saying, the stuff I'm telling you, God is telling you also on the inside. God is capable of speaking into your heart and your mind about things that he wants you to understand and believe. And not only that, but he sent me as a second voice, a second witness to the things that spiritually he gives to you, verbally I'll give to you. You'll get two hits, two witnesses. And one of the ways that you know that it's God is I've come to confirm it. Those things and those thoughts that you've been having about perhaps this leadership, the way we worship, the one who's coming, you felt all those things. I'm coming to clarify the things that God is speaking to you. And you'll know for sure. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory. But the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. Sometimes people like to talk a lot, come up with some great plans and great thoughts and great visions, and you trace it all back to what it's about, and somehow it's about them making themselves big, great, rich, noted, significant. Jesus didn't want to take the credit for the teaching and say, oh, aren't my words amazing? Oh, you think my words and teaching is marvelous? Thank you. Why, thank you. No, he said, this is the stuff that Dad's been speaking into some of you, and I'm just doing it out loud too. So this is from Dad. I'm here to confirm that what you're hearing is from Dad. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me? So he's now challenging, I think, an element in the crowd. The crowd is mixed. It's full of some people who are watching, some people have got some preconceived ideas, and other people who actually are briefed to spy on him and find a way, a weakness and a way to kill him. And so to those, he starts saying, you know what? I'm not false, but you are. You're in here, you're trying to kill me. The crowd, and I would rather say some in the crowd, but the crowd answered, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? So they're hiding. And they're slandering. And they're lying. These are the guys that have come to judge Jesus. And yet their behavior is, quite frankly, awful. Have you ever been accused of being a liar and having a demon? Did Jesus take it on the chin? Did he argue? Did he seek to justify himself? Jesus answered them, I did one work and you all marvel at it. Moses gave you circumcision, not that it's from Moses, but from the fathers. You circumcise a man on the Sabbath? If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? So the Jews had an issue because they'd inherited this rule that they had to circumcise. God wanted them to circumcise through Abraham. You're not even part of the group unless you circumcise. And that got handed down for hundreds and hundreds of years. And Moses, well, he broke that one because even though he was circumcised by his mum and dad, he didn't even circumcise his own children. God was quite angry with him and said, we're not even going to start ministering, Moses, until you circumcise your kids. So everybody knew that circumcision was important to belong to the people of God, the Jews. And Moses eventually fell in line and did it. He then gave all these extra rules from God, all these codes of conduct. And the rules that the Jews after Moses had put in place seemed to indicate that circumcision would sort of comply or come into the category of work. And on the Sabbath, you're not supposed to work. What do we do if your kid is born 8 days before the Sabbath? then he's got to have his circumcision on the Sabbath, but we're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. How do we do that? And there was an understanding that, of course, you've got to circumcise the child as per what God has said. And so Jesus is sort of pointing out this inconsistency and saying, you know, the way you make your rules and interpret the laws of God, the ones that Abraham and Moses gave to you, you know, I'm doing that with right judgment. You've got it all wrong. You know, actually, I'm the code maker. I'm not a code breaker. If you want to know how to interpret these rules, why don't you come to the code maker? I'm telling you what rules are to apply now and which ones we're going to change. Moses told you one was coming. Code maker's here. And just on a helicopter view of it all, like, would it be actually wrong to make someone well on a Sabbath day? Would that be a wrong thing to do? Just, does it pass your pub test that God would really not want me to help someone be whole? So then says, do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. I think that's gracious of Jesus. I think if I was facing a rowdy crowd that really had a heart to perhaps want to kill me, I probably wouldn't have gone there in the first place, just to show you the strength of Jesus and the heart of Jesus to even give these people a go. He did it cautiously. He didn't do it so that they would be inflamed and that they would be able to take him out. So he made sure he was in a place where everyone could see what was happening to him, rather than go down a roadway where he could be ambushed, where everyone was expecting to get him to walk from Galilee down to Jerusalem. He actually went in secret, arrived there, and started teaching in the public temple space. So there would have been lots of different people around for the feast, and lots of people spruiking on and teaching on about their particular teachings, different rabbis with their different groups. Well, he would have just taken a little spot down in and around the temple area, inside the precinct of the temple, and just started teaching. And at this time, it was sort of very quickly developed into a confrontation, an argument between the spies from the leadership ruling the temple and this renegade teacher. But despite that being the situation, he came to correct them. And he's basically saying, look, judge with right appearances. Do well. And that's a rebuke. It's a correction. It's for them. How did they take it? Some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, is not this the man whom they seek to kill? And here he is speaking openly. And they say nothing to him? Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? So because they were taking pot shots from the crowd, because they weren't coming with all the fanfare and regalia, but sending spies into the crowd, it was giving the impression that maybe they weren't against him, maybe they were against him. They were against him, all right. They just didn't want to do it openly. They were testing the waters and the feelings for Jesus. They were waiting for a time where the crowd would be against him before they'd openly move in public. Can it be the authorities really know that this is the Christ? But we know where this man comes from. And when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from. Okay, so there's part of the crowd in this collection of confused and somewhat aggressive individuals, an understanding that the Anointed One, the Saviour of the universe, the Eternal King, who happens to come from the Jews, is going to come suddenly to his temple and not really be known where he comes from. Just a sudden appearance rather than a birthed in a virgin or in a town or a place or any of that business. And they got that probably from verses and prophecies in Micah chapter 5, verse 2, where this figure, this Messiah anointed figure, the king, suddenly just comes to the temple. What do you do when there's confusion? Well, confusion arises because of partial truth. That is a truth. Christ will come suddenly. He will appear as an eternal ruler. But not the first time. First time he comes as a lamb for slaughter, for sins of the world. Second time, suddenly, ruler, king, fanfare, big time. Some of the crowd knew some of the prophecies, but they hadn't put them all together, which is quite understandable at this time because you need someone like Jesus to come along and say, look, I'm going to help you with the jigsaw puzzle of prophecy. Listen to me. Believe me. You'll understand everything written down much, much better than you do right now. So Jesus proclaimed as he taught in the temple. I love that. He's in enemy HQ speaking because he knows that the people are still undecided and so they can't overthrow him. You know me, and you know where I come from? But I have not come on my own accord. He who sent me is true, and him you do not know. I know him, for I come from him, and he sent me. Again, Jesus is speaking in a little bit of code here. What's he talking about? Well, some of them understood. So some of them were thinking, I think he's saying God sent him and we don't know God. It's pretty rude. Jesus, it's pretty rude. Especially the spiritual leaders who were infiltrating the crowd. They would have gone, oh, he's so rude. He's saying we don't know God. So they were seeking to arrest him. But no one laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. God the Father has a capacity to protect his people from hurt through influencing circumstances, minds and hearts. Yet many of the people believed in him. They said, when the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man has done? Okay, so you've got elements in the crowd who are offended. They're really upset. Probably running back to HQ saying, oh, it's not going well. Some of them are now believing. So the Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him, and the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. So the spies have gone back to HQ, which is probably like the ruling Sanhedrin. A combination of head Pharisees, head priests, the guys who make the decisions about what's appropriate behaviour in the temple precinct. You know, dispatch the security guards. Look, you think he's winning the crowd. Shut him down. Well, I just wonder whether Jesus saw the soldiers starting to come. These are the temple security guards. And Jesus then said, I will be with you a little longer, and then I'm going to him who sent me. Okay. So Jesus doesn't interpret all this aggression as, gee, things are getting out of control. You're now going to control where I'm going and when I'm going. The crowd can come at him. The security and the opposition can come at him. But his message to them is, I'll go when I'm going. And where I'm going, it's nothing to do with you. When I'm going, it's nothing to do with you. You think it is. Then he says, you will seek me, and you will not find me. Where I am, you cannot come. The Jews said to one another, where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion amongst the Greeks, teach the Greeks? What does he mean by saying, you will seek me, and you will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come? Well, I think it was fairly plain what Jesus is meaning there, saying, if you are going to stay in a position of opposition to me and not change and turn around and follow instead of affront me, you'll end up separated from me forever. And just in case you think you've got power and that you can do things to me that I don't want you to do to me, you don't. I go where I'm going according to what my Father says. And I go when I'm going according to when my Father says. On the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." Now this he said about the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive. For as yet the Spirit had not yet been given, because Jesus was not yet glorified. So he's sitting there, he's got all these people sort of milling around him, security guards, people calling him a demon, people arguing with him, people doubting him, and then some believing and others saying, "I think he's the one, I think he's the Christ." What a hotbed, what a mix. Just in case you're in any doubt about Jesus thinking that he's special, he jumps up and says, "It's me. You've got to come to me." Yeah, you've got all these options around. You've got your temple guys, your Sadducees, your Pharisees. You've got your blood sacrifices. You've got the big altar there. You've got all this old worship. But I'm telling you, it's not about that now. All right, it's about me. It's about you coming to me to get something, to survive forever. Not only will you survive, but you'll be quenched. Your thirst will be quenched. You won't feel dry spiritually. He said this about the Spirit whom he to those whom believed in him who were to receive. For as yet the Spirit had not yet been given. So this water is not available or accessible or drinkable to people who don't believe. But even though there were some who believed, they had not yet received. And so Jesus was talking about the time of Pentecost, which was at least sort of 6, 7, or 8 months away from the time he was speaking here, when he had been crucified, resurrected, walked amongst them for 40 days, ascended, and been with the Father in heaven for 10 days, and then at that time blessed the believing people with the fullness of the Spirit of God. That amazing time in Pentecost. And that was the order. I mean, Jesus was saying, I know this is coming. I know the wind is, he told Nicodemus earlier, look, the wind is going to blow. You don't know when and where. But Jesus was now sensing, yep, it's not yet. I've got to go through a number of different steps here before Father will release the Spirit to you. You know, the Son had to be not just sacrificed and his blood shed for our sins so that we may be cleansed. More than that, God actually wanted the Son to be raised up and seated in his seat next to the right hand of the Father, where the glory starts. Can you imagine that day? Well, Jesus ascends 50 days after the crucifixion, where man had said, "You're nothing, you're dirt, you deserve death." And Father said, "No, he deserves not just to be resurrected, but this one deserves the kingship. He's the king." And then he would have placed him next to his right hand in the very throne room at the center of all spiritual and earthly universe. And the glory. Imagine the reception. And then when that was done, Jesus then said to Dad, Is it time yet? Let's fill them up. Hey, Dad, you know when you filled me up, when I got baptized with the fullness of the Spirit? You know, those ones that are waiting? There's 120 of them down there praying in a room waiting 10 days. Let's give it to them. Let's give him the Spirit of God. And all things became different from then. So Jesus then made this astounding incognito claim about the Spirit, saying, "Living water, I'll give it to you." When they heard these words, some of the people said, "This really is the prophet." Others said, "This is the Christ." But some said, "Is the Christ to come from Galilee? Has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the offspring of David and comes from Bethlehem, the village where David was?" So there was a division amongst the people over him. Some of them wanted to arrest him, but no one laid hands on him. So now you've got this amazing confrontation spreading inside the crowd. Some are going, "Yeah, no, this guy's the one. This guy's the one." Others are going, "No, no." And they're coming up with all these arguments as to why he can't possibly be the one. Earlier, some in the crowd were arguing, "Well, he can't be the Christ because the Christ just appears, right?" But they were making an error of not using all the prophetic picture and putting all the pieces of the puzzle together, knowing that Jesus comes not just suddenly and in great glory, but also as the Lamb in the Virgin for sacrifice two times. But now they're a bit closer to it and they're saying, "Well, hang on a minute. Okay, we don't think..." This part of the crowd was saying, we don't think that he suddenly appears. We think actually he is born, but in Bethlehem, right? Because that's where David was from, and God said that the king would come through David's line, the Messiah, the Eternal One. So he must be from Bethlehem, right? And this guy's not, right? Yeah? But you can just see that in this milieu of confusion, some for, some against, you'd be a pretty brave security guy to say, "Let's take him now, shall we?" Be a gutsy call. The whole mob could turn on you and say, "What are you doing? We believe in him." Crowd riot. They were there to keep the temple peace. That would have been a surefire temple riot going right there. One part of the crowd against the other part, them trying to drag Jesus away from people who actually start to believe in him. It would have been pretty messy. So what did they do? The officers then came to the chief priests and the Pharisees, who said to them, "Why'd you not bring him?" The officers answered, "No one ever spoke like this man." Okay. I think they were probably scared. But the very brave big general leaders stood back, sent spies in. They weren't game to come and debate him openly. Then they sent, rather than come with their soldiers, they sent their soldiers by themselves to go get him. Not so brave, these guys. Like to do things behind the scenes. It's not a good sign for a leader. "No one ever spoke like this man." The Pharisees answered, "Have you also been deceived? Have any of the authorities," that's them they're talking about, "any of the authorities or the Pharisees believed in him? But this crowd that does not know the law is accursed." So they're frustrated. And they're basically saying the crowd's dumb. They don't know the law well enough. We are the experts. How dare they? Nicodemus was one of these guys, but who had leanings towards Jesus. Nicodemus, who had gone to him before and who was one of them, that's the Sanhedrin, said to them, "Does our law judge a man without first giving him a hearing and learning what he does?" So he's now pointing out the inconsistency of these leaders. They've sent spies with their predetermined charge against the guy, a false one, to arrest him. Nicodemus is calling them out on it, saying, "I think we have to establish a charge and before we can arrest somebody. Don't we do that? Isn't that what we're all about with the law? They replied, "Are you from Galilee?" How about that? There's a label right there. If you don't like the message of a person that is actually true, then play the man. They didn't like the truth of what Nicodemus was saying, so they slurred the man. I think that's something to watch out for. If confrontations are becoming personal instead of issue-related, then that's a sign that godliness is going out the window. "Are you from Galilee too? Search and see that no prophet arises from Galilee." Prophets do arise from Galilee. Jonah came from Galilee. Nahum came from Capernaum, Kappa town, Nahum, named after him, Capernaum. He came from there. So it's a crazy thing for them to say. I don't know if they're just angry, they're losing the argument. They're now resorting to more open lying. Not 100% sure why they even said that. Okay, so just having a rethink. You've got Jesus taking a calculated risk coming down to the temple. He knows if he is cavalier or too open that he'll be taken. And so he takes precaution, but nevertheless penetrates into the heart of the group that are deceiving God's people. He calls them to account with the intention of rebuke and correction, not humiliation. It doesn't go well, because the people who he is talking to are not godly, and they don't have God's conscience speaking to their heart, and they react. They use secrecy, spying, slander, lying. All weapons that Jesus was never going to use. Enough of the crowd. Offer protection to Jesus, because Father had been speaking into their hearts and saying, "It's true, it's true." And belief protected the Lord that day. But it is a salutary reminder that rebuke will cause the flesh in others to rise. And without God's protection, it can be quite difficult. And perhaps it might be a moment to think of leaders, good, godly, spiritual leaders that have gone before, that seem to have been slandered and sidelined. And that was going to happen in a big way to Jesus, probably only 7 months, 6 or 7 months after this event. Yet God has the final say. Jesus does rise. Jesus wins. All right, well, we'll be moving on into John chapter 8, which has a story about a woman caught in adultery and the argument with these difficult, fleshy Jewish leaders continues. We'll see you in John chapter 8.